There we go. So I hope you had a wonderful Christmas tide and a good start to a new year and a new decade. We resume our study of the Gospel of Luke with chapter 15, which of course contains one of the best series of parables and probably the best long parable in all of the Gospels. So we'll just jump on in and find out where we find ourselves. Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling and saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. "Which of one of you, having 100 sheep and losing one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders and rejoices. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost.' Just so, I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one of them, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? When she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost.' Just so I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." Then Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me.' So he divided his property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant country. And there he squandered his property on dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything to eat. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? But here I am, dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field. And when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has got him back safe and sound.' Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him, but he answered his father, 'Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him.' Then the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found.'" The word of the Lord.
Amen.
So, it's really a continuation of chapter 14 when you think about it in terms of who belongs where. Because most of chapter 14 was consumed with this feast that was being given, and the original invitees were finding excuses why they couldn't go. You know, oh, I'm getting married that day, as if you might not have known that in advance. I've bought a piece of property, now I need to go to take a look at it. You know, and so people who were not originally invited, in Luke's perspective, Gentiles, are then brought in. Basically, the servants are sent out to find anybody that they can find in the streets. And the hall still isn't full of guests. And so this powerful sort of Lord sends them out again and says, compel people to come. You know, and this is a vision of the kingdom that Jesus has, you know, particularly in comparison, you know, with those who exalt themselves, like the Pharisees. And so Jesus was spending time with a lot of dirty so-and-sos, and the religious elite didn't like that, and they're grumbling. And so he tells three parables: the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin, and the parable of the lost or prodigal son, which could also be called the parable of the generous and or crazy father, or the parable of the two sons, because it's ironic that the son who stayed at home, who felt so terribly betrayed and neglected, is likewise neglected in our interpretation of this parable. He comes in near the end, and it's unpleasant, and we want to stick with the party, and we leave him alone, but we're going to spend time with him today. So the first couple of parables are, you know, same story, different setting. Shepherds were responsible for guiding sheep. They're not terribly bright, and it's easy in a flock for them to stray off and put themselves in the position where they can't get back out again.
That's because sheep don't look where they're going.
That's right. They look at the grass in front of their face. And then, you know, so all of a sudden you've walked your way down into a gully that was easy enough to walk your way down into, but you can't get back out. It's too steep to climb out. And it's really wild, you know, what he does. With no evidence of there being other shepherds or even sheepdogs, he leaves behind 99 sheep, you know, who are going to have to fend for themselves against predators, against thieves, because he wants that one lost sheep back so incredibly badly. And that's how God feels about us, that the rejoicing in heaven over someone who repents, who turns their lives around and returns to faithful covenant relationship with God, is greater than the 99 righteous who need no repentance, which is kind of a bit of a joke anyway, because everybody needs repentance. And, you know, and he was kind of pushing the bruise, as I like to call it, you know, putting the thumb on the bruise with those Pharisees. They're already pretty upset that he's hanging out with these sort of very exorbitant sinners. But he's basically looking, it's like, well, you know, God's really happy when a tax collector like Matthew decides to straighten himself up and fly right and follow God, you know. And, you know, heaven gets excited about that. Why would heaven get excited about you? You're already righteous. I mean, what's the point? I mean, can you just, if you think, if you can say the insinuation out loud, and you almost feel the corkscrew sort of going into your side yourself. And then with the woman with the 10 silver coins, these were probably drachmas, which is about a day's wage. Not too different from a denarii. And she has 10, she loses one. And it's not an insignificant amount of money. Trying to think. It would be like, well, it's hard to think of a contemporary counterpoint, but she's lost 10% of her stash, and she basically turns the house upside down to find it. And it's interesting. What interests me here is when I lose something, like my glasses or my cell phone or whatever, and I finally find it after an extensive search, I have to confess, I'm just like, well, that's 20 minutes of my life I'm not getting back. You know, what an idiot. Well, who would ever think of putting his cell phone in the freezer when he was in there to get ice cream? Yes, that's happened before. And you know, this woman is delighted, and she brings her friends together to celebrate. And something else I've always thought, but I've never seen any sort of scholarly commentator comment upon, is that there's always a party after what was lost has been found. And in the first two parables in particular, we're dealing with things of a specific measurable worth. And when you get together for a party, what do? You drink, you eat. So what does that mean? Well, it means that, you know, you may be down to a permanent herd of 99 or even 98 because you brought these people together to celebrate that you found the lost sheep. But what are you going to feast on? Well, sheep. You know, and this woman who's calling people together to rejoice, you know, a day's wage wouldn't put a small dent in what it would cost to have even a, you know, low-key celebration with a small group of friends. I mean, maybe the implication of, you know, this celebration, this feasting, is just my read because of where we've been with the great feast in the Lord's house in chapter 14, but you lose, you find, and then in rejoicing you give, and the net gain appears to be zero, but it isn't, because the net gain is joy. Net gain is joy. Oh, no, I mean, if it's...
And that's a celebration, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, it's, you know... Yeah, but it specifically talks about bringing over friends and neighbors, mm-hmm. You know. I would never call any of you to the house when I found my cell phone after 2 days of missing, you know, because I... too embarrassed, but... I mean, there's a sense of communal rejoicing, and it offers a nice balance, because Jesus in all four Gospels is primarily illustrated as a community focused person, the type of radical individualism that we practice in our country. Would have been offensive to Jesus. In fact, if it made any sense to him at all. But this is a case where, with the lost coin, the lost sheep, you have the affirmation of the value of the individual. But that value can only be recognized within the context of community. Okay? What happens when the sheep is found? What happens when the coin is found? The loser and the finder brings together their friends to celebrate, and analogously, what happens in heaven? That is the sinner who repents, and there is celebration in the community of heaven. So it's a definition of individual value within the context purely of a broader community, which is something I think that we've in large part lost track of. And not just here, but in many parts of the world, where community is viewed as a hindrance and more trouble than it's worth, or impossible to actually have. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon in Atlanta when we lived and worked there. Working with the 20s and 30s group in Atlanta, it was very hard to get that group close. And I was puzzled as to why, because they fit together like a puzzle. so why I couldn't sort of get them to mesh well challenged me. It wasn't until I realized is that none of them expected to be there for more than 2 or 3 years. Then they got a better offer, or their company moved them to Boston or to Austin or to wherever. And so what was the point, really? You know, what's the point in, you know, really investing in a support group or a faith connection or your neighborhood? Because nobody really expects to be there more than 2 or 3 years. And the odd thing was is that as I was pondering this one day, very frustrated, it occurred to me that I'd gone to Atlanta not planning to stay much more than 3 or 4 years myself, you know. And once I sort of got that figured out in my head and we started talking about it as a group, it's like, well, how can we experience community in a meaningful way even though we know that, you know, half of us will not be here in a couple of years? And that's actually when intimacy began to be formed, is when you accept what is. But even, yeah, just the desire for community, because with community you have things like, I don't know, accountability, expectations, standards of behavior, consequences.
I grew up in a community like that in Washington, where the neighborhood was mostly Army and Navy men, mm-hmm. and their families, and they were there for at the Pentagon for 2-3 mm-hmm. years, and then they were in the Philippines or Iran or gosh knows where, and it was a constant revolving door there in that neighborhood, and there were a few people like my family that were there permanently, mm-hmm. but I guess that they had another group, the Army or the Navy, mm-hmm. that they were invested in as a community, and yeah. they were very much into, even though they were only there for a couple of years, they were very much into the total community of where they mm-hmm. were at the time.
Yes.
So I guess it must have been the service background that they had that made it so. Mm-hmm. Because what you described was not mm-hmm. what I grew up in.
Well, and I think that when you're looking at something like the military is an institution that its normal is constant movement.
That's right.
So you learn how to create and exist within a community that for most everybody else would be viewed as terribly short-lived. But you realize that your life is going to be comprised of an entire sequence of these short-term groups, and then you're going to be sent there. And so that's an institutionalized reality that if when you walk into it, you may not know, you know what to expect intellectually. You may not be able to anticipate how it's going to feel, at least initially, but then you adapt because everyone around you is having to adapt to the same thing. This is a point in time when we were first getting, you know, in the late 90s to a place where, you know, okay, this is no longer a blip on a radar screen anymore. Not only will you have several jobs during your lifetime, you'll probably have several careers during your lifetime. Companies do not care about you as an employee, period. Once you're useless, you're gone. Or if someone's just a scintilla more useful than you, you are gone. And of course, that lack of loyalty, you know, from company to employee was reciprocated 100%, where the employee was like, if I can make a dollar more, mm-hmm. bye-bye. And it really was the beginnings of what we're still in, which is the most vicious, unrestrained form of capitalism that could be envisioned. I mean, Adam Smith, if he was resurrected today, would probably do a lot of screaming, some vomiting, some writing. This is not what he had in mind in terms of his vision of the reality of capitalism. And of course, that was over 300 years ago. Things have changed, but you know, it's hard for us to connect sometimes with, you know, this idea that, oh, you lost a $100 bill and you finally found it, and so now you're gonna have a block party and spend your $100 bill having the block party. But that, within the context of the kingdom of God, only made sense. And that, well, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. Mm-hmm. The young people, the youth, the young adults, do they not have an under visceral desire to be part of a community, though?
Oh, yeah.
That or they don't even know what it is.
Yeah, that they don't even know what it mm-hmm. is.
So, yeah.
But there's got to be this hunger there.
Well, I mean,
because we are social humans. We are.
Yeah, human beings are social creatures, and young people, at least the ones that I encounter, do have a desire for community, and are prepared to make considerable sacrifices and commitments to be in a friend group, whether that be religiously oriented. Some of the mega churches that we often disdain for various reasons, the reason they're able to hold together with any sense of continuity is they have small groups for everybody. And in fact, the expectation is that you meet with a small group. What do you do in a small group? First of all, you meet for at least 1 hour every single week. It doesn't matter when or where, and it's just your small group. And you're going to get together, and you're going to pray together. You're going to reflect on a few verses of Scripture. You can talk about where Jesus has been within your life, okay? And if people talk about, oh, all the young people, you know, go over there, or all the young people go over there, it's because there's a structure waiting for them that provides them with a context for accessible community, you know. My children have friend groups that they're very faithful to, spend as much time with as possible. They're very generous and caring towards one another. They get together physically to be together, usually in our house. A lot of people, I think, look at, you know, virtual means of communication, and certainly that's something that's used, but you know, I was, you know, in a snark because, you know, Emma had been on Snapchat or FaceTime or Instagram. I don't even know what any of those are, but she uses them. And, I just thought, you know, this is silly. You know, young woman lives 5 minutes away. We could pick her up, bring her here. They could enjoy each other's company. But, you know, what would I do when I was in high school? I'd go home and, do my homework and eat dinner, and I would call my friends on the phone, you know, and I'd be on the phone for hours. And this is back when, you know, if one person on the house was on the phone, nobody else in the house could be on the phone. And I can remember there being amplified conversations around, you know, the amount of time that I was on the phone, and my parents need to use it. So there is a desire. I think that the biggest impediment, actually, for most people, including most young people, when it comes to forming community, is an insecurity, a fear that if they are vulnerable enough to become even modestly intimate with another group of people in friendship, that the pain and loss of betrayal would be so great that it would just be better off not engaging in it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember, you know, this younger generation, their overarching context, you know. I was born in 72, okay? So my overarching context is Nixon's resignation, the Vietnam War, hyperinflation, and really ugly clothes. Because I was in my most formative ages, I was in the 70s, all right? Okay. What about my son? He was born on December the 3rd, 2011. We have literally been at war in Afghanistan nearly every day Ben's been alive. Our first strikes came in October, but we didn't invade formally until later in the year. Huh? Sorry. 2001, right, 2001, sorry. So yeah, he is 17, just turned 18, and he has never lived in a country that has not been at war. Since the day he was born, we've been at war. That's the overarching context for him. The reality that he got his first cell phone when he was 11. Not to indulge him, but because it was, we never told him this, but it was for his security. Because we could tag him using the GPS and always know where he was in the neighborhood. And, I mean, it was a safe neighborhood, about as safe as you could hope for, in Williamsburg. And, that's why I got the phone, is that if he needed to call us, he could. Or if we wanted to find him and couldn't, we could call. And so we could track his butt on his GPS. Mm-hmm. You know, just to make sure that, you know, he had, for whatever reason, not left the neighborhood or the playground at the school or whatever. So, I mean, and he does a good job, as Emma does too, of being in community. But I'm not sure that other people are equally well adapted. I mean, it's a threatening world. If you've been born in the last 20 years, that's all you've ever known, is existential, mortal threat. And not just with terrorists, but with, you know, people with bump stock AR-15s and, you know, hotel windows in Las Vegas, or popping into schools or movie theaters. And the scary thing is people aren't even thinking it through well. These are all kinds of lethal concoctions that you can insert into the HVAC system of any building that you could buy from your local hardware department and find the recipe for it online. And you could gas 1,000 people and never have to pull a trigger. Why they don't do that, I don't know. But thank God that they don't, for whatever reason. So anyway, and so the first two are about loss, retrieval, rejoicing, community. The second half of the chapter, which is the parable of the prodigal son, is about that same discontinuity being reconciled, but within a much more complex setting. Because, you know, the 99 sheep probably aren't having a conversation among themselves saying, I wonder where the other sheep went. We're missing a sheep. I'm concerned about the sheep. Do you think the sheep, like, stole the shepherd's purse and he's in Vegas, you know, spending it all on craps tables and hookers? You know, I don't know. And the thing with the coin, I mean, you know, you're dealing with 10 inanimate objects. But here, you're talking about people, real people, three primary characters with a considerable side cast. And it's intriguing that in Scripture, it seems like God has this peculiar preference for the younger over the elder, which would have been in contradistinction to the normal economic functioning of that culture, and for most of cultures for most of time, where the eldest male receives the bulk, if not the entirety, of the inheritance. And the eldest male is always the one who is favored. But in Scripture, I mean, who knows why? There are so many different theological answers in their specific context, but Jacob and Esau. Joseph was not the eldest, not by far. David was the youngest brother, but he ended up becoming king. You could even look at that in a way with John the Baptist and Jesus. John was the elder cousin, but it was the younger cousin who, you know, was really bringing it. So the younger brother goes to his father and he's like, "I'd like my inheritance now, please." And that's really negative on a couple of different scales. You know, you could try to look on the bright side and say, "Oh, isn't it great that he wants to, you know, strike out on his own and be independent?" And you know, but no, that's not what this is about. This is beyond rude. It's sort of like if you went to somebody and said, "You're taking way too long to die, so I know that you're going to give me half," which actually is a big ask for a younger brother. So he's probably asking for more than he would have ordinarily received. "So, you know, since I can't wait for you to kick off, if you wouldn't mind just giving me the money now, that would be really helpful." So this is cruel. This is a really cruel thing for a son to say to his father. And then it places the father and his elder brother under significant difficulty. You know, just imagine if all of a sudden half of all you owned was gone. And then you and your spouse or a sibling or whatever have to figure out a way to keep on going with 50% of what you'd had before. That's what the father and the elder brother are having to deal with. And this younger brother was a brat. He packs it up. He goes, you know, a long way away. And he squandered his property in dissolute living, which from the Greek can also be translated, he went to college and joined a social fraternity. I did both, as you might recall. He's broke. At the exact same time, there was a famine, so there was a shortage of food. He hired himself out as a day laborer. It wasn't nearly enough to feed him, though. It was hard times for everybody. And he would have even been happy to, you know, just eat the slop that he was feeding the pigs. Which the stuff that pigs get fed the stuff that absolutely no one or no thing else could possibly manage to eat. I mean, pigs will eat veritably anything. That's what slop is. It's literally junk. They'll just eat junk. Have a nice bacon burger. And when you consider that this is stories being told within a Jewish context, the idea that he's having to slop pigs in the first place would have been immensely denigrating and defiling. And the fact that he's prepared to eat with them. I mean, I have this image of his face in a trough of slop between two pigs. I mean, it's just how, you know, a complete void of any sense of dignity or self-worth. But he was desperate, he was hungry, he was starving. And in a moment of clarity, he said, "You know, all my dad's slaves are just fine. And here I am about to starve to death." So he concocts this plan in his head. "I'll go to my dad and I'll say, 'You know, what I did was wrong. I don't expect you to accept me like a son. I'm not worthy to be your son. Just, you know, if you'd hire me off as a hand.'" And so he goes. Before he even has a chance to start his speech, his father sees him and starts running. Running for men in that part of the world, both then and in some cases now, is considered undignified. I never realized that until I got to seminary. And being in Washington, it was just, well, not in Washington. I went to seminary in Alexandria, Virginia, and an Episcopal seminary just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. So for foreign students from among the now 8 seminaries that we have flung across the United States, ours made sense, you know, because there are embassies right there if they need that kind of help or whatever. And, you know, they can make more connections. And so we had a lot of students there from all over the world. And I remember, for whatever reason, I started running. I think it might have been raining. I can't remember the circumstances. And a guy who was in the class with me, Daniel Ding Bull, who is still somehow the Archbishop of South Sudan, and a marvelously brave person, but very patronizing and patriarchal. And I mean, the Dinka, for instance, the men eat, and then if there's food left over, the women eat. When his wife came to visit, I avoided the refectory like the plague because I couldn't stand to sit there and watch him eat, and then when he got done, eat if there was anything left, as if the refectory was ever going to run out of anything. But I learned a lot from Daniel and from many others from around the world. And he said, "You should not do that." I said, "What? Run. You're a grown man. You should not do that. Undignified." And he said, and I thought, that's interesting. So, and then when you apply it to this, it makes you see it in a whole different way. You know, here's the son who's just been an absolute cad, and he's coming back. For all daddy knows, he's coming back to ask for more. He's got this slick little speech that he's practiced. He rolls that out. Dad basically ignores that. Starts, you know, shouting out, "Bring a robe, the best one. A ring for his finger, sandals for his feet. Get the fatted calf, kill it. We're going to have a party here." I thought he was dead. Now he's alive again. He's back. And when I had a child, my first child being a son, I only at that moment began to understand how the father in the story felt. You know, because I just honestly can't imagine anything that he could possibly do that could cause me to give up on him or not love him anymore or not be ecstatic to see him, especially if I thought perhaps he'd gone off and died or something, or gotten himself so lost that he couldn't get back home. And of course, this is an allegory where the unrighteous, the people who aren't Pharisees and scribes, we're all the prodigal son. God is the father, okay? Which would make the elder son who stayed behind the Pharisees and the scribes. And the elder son hears what's going on, and remember, he's having to work twice as hard. You know, he's got to pick up his younger brother's duties now too. So it'd be hard to blame him for feeling some resentment. And so he comes in to find out what's going on, and he says, "Hey, what's up?" to one of the slaves. He says, "All your brother's back. Your dad's really excited. You know, the big fat calf, it's cooking right now. Smells great." The elder son just about pops a blood vessel. He gets so angry. I can't blame him. I mean, you know, it's like when some ignorant, selfish jerk gets rewarded, you know, and the people who have been conscientious and faithful and kind are just ignored. And so he's not going in to join the party. And so we've just had one fracture in the family heal, but another one has been created. And it's interesting because both fractures are created because of the father's generosity. You know, the younger son came to the father and said, yeah, half of it, give me now. The father didn't have to give him anything. He could have said, if you don't want to live here anymore, that's fine, get a walking. But as far as you taking half of our assets, good luck with that. But he gave it to him. And then when he came back, he gave him even more. It was the generosity of the father that created the fraction. So the question in the parable is, how do people respond to the father's generosity? Do we take advantage of it? Do we abuse it? Do we feel resentment when it seems to be extended to people more than it is extended to us? Or when is it extended to people that we feel are undeserving of God's mercy and grace? So, you know, Jesus talks about, did you think that I came to bring peace? No, I came to break families in two, like those little thin breadsticks you get at fancy Italian restaurants, you know. And that's the issue, is that Jesus doesn't come down to create enmity. It's the reality of human nature, sinful human nature, that God's love generates all sorts of negative emotions that lead to fractures. And this is something that I think oftentimes is overlooked in this parable, is at the source of all the disruption is God's generosity. So dad comes out to talk to older brother, and he said, come on, join us. This is an exciting moment. I don't want you to miss it. And he says, look, I've been busting my butt for you ever since that jerk little brother of mine went away. And I've done everything you told me. And you've never even given me a young goat to celebrate with my friend. And every time I read that, and maybe it's you too, I think, yeah, but did you ever ask your dad for a goat? Did you ever ask your dad, or just expect dad to at some point say, you are so awesome, here, eat this goat? And so he's, you know, I've been so good. And but this son's come back and he's just wasted, you know, his money with, you know, prostitutes and all kinds of loose living. And the father says, listen, all that I have is yours. And you'll always be with me. But now we have a situation where somebody was dead and has come back to life, has been lost, has been found. And this time it's not a sheep or a coin. It's a person. It's a brother. It's a son. And so part of the challenge is, when you're a Christian, is not feeling resentment. Because we feel like, you know, I work hard, I plow my furrow, you know, I'm very consistent about practicing my faith as fully as I can, and then we see someone we find undeserving who is objectively, you know, less faithful, you could argue, in terms of their behavior, and for whatever reason they're rewarded or promoted, and it can be incredibly frustrating, and it can be you know, a situation where you can feel really resentful. And the idea is, if God's ready to be generous, we need to be ready to be generous. If God's ready to celebrate, we need to be ready to celebrate. So they say at a square dance, he's calling the ball. And but knowing that we are also the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son or daughter, it's also tremendous comfort, because we do recognize that we do recognize that there's hope. There's hope.
Michael,
yeah.
In order for this story to work, does the prodigal, does he have to be genuine in his offer to his dad to work as a servant? Or I could almost see him going, well, you know, I'll make the offer, but my dad would not require that of
him. Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, discussion around how sincere he was, because it wasn't really till he hit rock bottom that he was willing to go back. And it's pretty clear from what we're told in the parable how his mind was processing this. It wasn't, I've done the most awful thing to my father, my older brother. I can't believe what I've been doing this whole time, and I've got to find some way to make it back up to them. Maybe if I just went back home and spent the rest of my life as their slave, you know. But instead he's like, I'm going to die, and dad's slaves have plenty to eat. And so I'll go and say, yeah, okay, so I get that you don't want me as a son anymore, but you know I'm a good worker. So, you know, enslave me. I'm all yours. I like bracelets, you know, take me on. So this definitely does appear to be a gambit. Numerous commentators that I've read on the Gospel of Luke talk about how they refer to this as this elaborate, well-structured, you know, manipulative kind of speech where he plays on his father's pity and his own pitifulness and says, oh, I'm so sorry if you can believe that. Yeah, so he was going to gain dad again. I mean, I think he probably expected that being brought on as a slave was the best he could probably hope for. But it was a lot better. So yeah, he was going to try to find a way in some small part to take advantage of his father anyway. And where the parable leaves us, because, you know, no story can tell you all the endings. But we don't know if this experience of celebration changed the younger brother. And we never find out if the older brother ever went to the party. It just stops. That's, the best stories are like that. They leave you wondering.
I think we make deals like that with God. I think we make deals like that with God, or make offers like that.
Mm-hmm.
In times of trouble or whatever,
yeah.
We're not that sincere, you know.
That's the story.
We think we are.
That's the story of Abraham and Isaac. We all have our Isaacs.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's, you know, I think that, you know, in times of desperation, you know, where we're trying to sort of strike a deal with God because we can't imagine any other way out, we're trying to manipulate the situation to get an outcome that we find at least tolerable. I think that in the moment there is a significant degree of sincerity, and at the very least what we have to give ourselves and other people credit for is that A, we believe that we're dealing with a God who listens. B, we're dealing with a God who cares. C, we're dealing with a God who's willing to consider entering into a covenant with us. Because that's, you know, this grand covenant that we speak of, it's a deal, a really lopsided deal to our favor. And so we have a God who's willing to parlay with us, you know, which is a great blessing. It's not optimal, but it's better than nothing.
I heard a different take on it. The father remembered, knew what the son had gone through, mm-hmm. and knew that the son was coming back dirty, coming back with habits, coming back with part of what he had experienced, and wasn't going to go away soon. He was still kind of besmirched. The father knew that, but still accepted it. Mm-hmm. So, what that said to me was, we come to him, maybe we're making deals, maybe we're not, whatever, he accepts us, knowing that we've made a deal, knowing that we're besmirched, knowing that we're going to fall back, knowing that we have, still have these habits, but he still accepts us, and he still loves us. That's what this story says to me.
Oh, yeah. We're only human. I mean, and humanity is a great thing. And, you know, the incarnation of the Son in Jesus is meant to show us what the fullness of humanity can be. I mean, in essence, if you've ever read any Richard Rohr, true humanness as creatures created in the image of God is basically divine. So if a creature lives in the fullness of their humanness, of their imago Dei nature, as Jesus did, then what you have is divinity. And it's just a two-step forward, one-step back, or no, it's the other way, one-step forward, two-step back. All right, it's a country song. You got to be losing ground. So it's one step forward, two steps back, and...
he falls short of the glory.
And, you know, and to celebrate the victories. I mean, it's so easy to lose sight of, you know, things that we have to celebrate communally as a congregation and individually, and it's just easy to kind of let that slide by. You know, oh well, that should have happened. You know, that, you know, it's you have to honor the blessings that God's pouring into each of us individually and aggregately as a congregation. We got to party. Every three of these parables ends with a party. How are we doing on time?
Oh, all the time. From the older son, he's not even invited.
Well,
he's toiling away in the field.
That's a good
comes
point.
Comes walking home and he says that there's noise going on.
Yeah.
You know, the dad hasn't thought to say, hey.
Go get Roger. Go yeah, go get Roger.
You know, he's bringing home and they've been dressed up too.
Yeah. Well, and it's chaotic, and obviously Dad's a little overwrought. But you make a good point. The way he finds out is he comes in at the end of the day, after, you know, probably just sweaty, nasty, dusty from the fields, and you know, there's a party going on, and he's thinking, "What on earth?" And you know, maybe he was a little excited. Maybe he thought, "Oh, it's for me."
Yeah.
I do too. I mean, it's excuse me. Hello. I'm sorry, I did not call you. Well, I think somebody's spoofing us both then, because I don't have this number in my contact list because there's no name associated with it. I hope you have a great day, and then let's hope it stops. Bye-bye. That's the new spoof. I've gotten 6 calls from this number, and it's just like, well, that ain't me, buddy. That's somebody else. Very, very sorry to be you.
Mr. Mr. Unknown.
I will say this. I do think that corporal punishment should be returned for the people who do these frickin' spoofing attacks and, you know, phishing scams and stuff like, I mean, they, like, their fingers should be broken or something so they can never type on a computer keyboard again. I know it sounds harsh, but, you know.
Forgiveness and kindness, Father.
No, I blow Christiane. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, seriously. It, and see, that's the thing, though. It's like, we can talk about this in the abstract. Say, oh, yes, yes, yes. You know, but, you know, I get called twice in the last 5 minutes from a scammer. I'm pretty sure the first one was where, like, you know, the IRS was coming to get me or there was a lien on my property or something. And this is one of those guys that's like, you know, tries to engage in a conversation and then starts saying, well, you know, who are you anyway? And, you know, get as much information as they can. You know, and if you let them go on for a while, it gets really entertaining because they threaten to turn you into the cops, you know, but, you know, we could work that out and all that. And I have to tell you, you know, I do not like being interrupted. Any one of you, pop your head in my office, you're always more than welcome. That's not an interruption. That's a break. But this, I don't like people being obnoxious, and I don't like people trying to be deceitful, and I especially don't like people who do this thing when they're people who are vulnerable enough that they could get caught up into it and have something that they could lose. So what we have to do is we have to take all this mercy and loving kindness. We have to take, you know, the elder son in the field, and we have to bring that into our reality. And our reality is that I have rather unkind, violent thoughts about people who spoof me or try to spoof me. And I just think to myself, can't they be found? Can't they be arrested? Can't something be done to them? You know, like if they ever touch a computer keyboard again in their lives, they'll be electrocuted. Can't something be done to make these people stop? Because it's extremely annoying. They're having the time of their lives. And, you know, I just, so as you can see, and who knows, maybe it was godly sent. To put this within an everyday sort of situation where.
Righteous anger.
A measure of it is, but the vengeance piece of it, that belongs to God alone.
Our television shows the ID from the phone. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there. House phone rings, and it's Judith Chard.
Your home number, you've had that.
Yeah, if I hadn't been there, Arthur would have answered it. Mm-hmm. And who knows what he would have gotten into. I'm like, is it really Judith Chard?
Absolutely.
You know, there's
something. Yeah, far away.
His brother thing. When the other son answers his son-in-law's, he doesn't even acknowledge that this is his brother.
Yeah.
And is that because we have a hard time acknowledging others that have fallen the way this man has or this son has as brothers?
Well, I mean, it's the younger son essentially betrayed his family. Even if he'd taken the money and gone off somewhere and made good with it, it still would have been a cruel thing and a hardship that he imposed and asking more than was his due and well before it was his due. But he went off and he just wasted it. I mean, he was incredibly self-indulgent, very selfish, very, you know, impulse-driven, pleasure-oriented young man. And so he has nothing to bring back except his own shame. And there's a tendency to reciprocity. Okay, if you're going to betray me and turn your back on me, fine. I'm going to turn my back on you. You're not my brother anymore. My brother would never do what you're doing right now. And part of the process of forgiveness is to resist the temptation to reciprocity. We always think of forgiveness as something that occurs after a discrete event. But a lot of times forgiveness can begin as the event is occurring by refusing to reciprocate. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so what the older brother had done was, whether immediately or over the course of time, we don't really have a clear idea of how long the son had been away, probably a period of years. But he just said, hey, you know, that's fine. You don't want to be a part of our lives? Don't be a part of our lives. You aren't a part of our lives anymore. You're not my brother. You know, and then he's probably angry with his dad for giving him a half anyway. It was more than his fair share as the younger son under their usual rules. And so this poor older brother is just full of resentment. He resents his dad's generosity twice over. He resents his younger brother's audaciousness and fecklessness. Boy.
Is this too far a reach to equate this as an allegory between the Gentiles and the Jews?
No, that's definitely there. Uh-huh.
Okay. I can see places where that fits.
The question is who is what and what is which?
Yeah. And now the father says to the older brother, your brother. He gives him right back to him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially when you consider Luke's overall orientation, where there's such a strong emphasis in his gospel on the inclusion of the Gentiles, which it sets up Acts of the Apostles, the sequel, and Paul's missionary journeys, and a few episodes where Peter breaks the boundaries and goes off kosher for a good reason. The question I keep having to ask myself is who am I in the middle of this, and who would it be best to be? And obviously, the father is the ideal. None of us can fully achieve that. None of us can be God, but we are called to strive to be like God. You know.
Are we not both brothers?
I think there's a piece of each brother inside of us. Yeah, absolutely. And that's painful because when the brothers inside fight against each other, and you got, you know, one brother saying this, the other brother saying that. I mean, you know what it's like. Trying to make a difficult decision, or even a decision that's not that difficult, but it's deciding to decide, if that makes any sense. And sometimes it's just deciding to make a decision that's incredibly difficult, and we have to be kind to both children inside of us. If we're cruel to one and indulgent to the other, then it just magnifies the problem. So we have to be loving and accepting of both brothers and help reconcile them so that we can be whole and at one with each other and with other people and with God. Oh, it's 11 o'clock. Well, let's say a quick prayer.